All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you so much for joining us. And now it is once again my favorite part of the show. It's time for our interview, and we're going to do this a little bit differently this time because, as you guys know, we're crunched for time on the normal radio broadcast, and this is a really important interview with a really bright guy who I think has done some really good work, and I want you to hear the whole thing, but if you can't, and if you're not a podcast person, we're going to do the broad strokes of this gentleman's theory and what he sees going on. We're going to do these broad strokes here in the first 5, 6, 7 minutes so we can kind of give you the case of what he's looking at so you know what to look for. And then we're going to break down the details. So we're kind of going to do this in reverse order just because I think that this is such a prescient topic. And I think it is so important, and I want everybody to know this. But again, I'd encourage you to go to the podcast, Know Your Risk Radio podcast, knowyourriskradio.com, download and subscribe the podcast so you can hear all of his reasoning for that. So anyway, let's get rolling. So without further ado, I want to introduce to the Know Your Risk Radio audience, Edwin Dorsey. Edwin is writes a investment newsletter. He's written for Seeking Alpha. Worked at some short selling funds and has been mentored by some of the best short sellers in the business. He's a young guy, but extremely sharp. And I think he's got some real promise in this industry. So anyway, Edwin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Zach, so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, you bet. Well, hey, I noticed some of your work. And my radio, our listening audience knows my thoughts on a lot of this high-flying tech stuff, namely Tesla. And at the epicenter of that has become has come an investor who I'll tip my cap to, who I have nothing but respect for her returns. That is Kathy Wood. But to me, her funds, her company ARK, to me is the epicenter of this overvaluation in tech and this unbridled exuberance and this idea that fundamentals don't matter and valuation doesn't matter. And so I have been watching the stocks that they're invested in at ARK as sort of a barometer to see when this whole tech trade unwinds. And you did what you do, which is, unlike me just watching a few stocks, you really started digging into it and put out some really interesting data. And I want you to give us the broad strokes of what you see, what concerns you, and how you think it can impact the markets. And then as we move forward, let's dive into the details. But if you could, in the next 3 to 5 minutes, kind of give us the broad strokes of what you see, what concerns you, and how you think this could play out.
Zach, absolutely. So ARK Invest is a super hot, active ETF management firm. Their assets just this year have gone from about $10 billion to $60 billion over the last 12 months. That's mainly driven by their outstanding returns. Their main ETF, the ARK Innovation ETF, is up like 600% over the last 5 years. And this firm is run by Kathy Wood, and it's the hottest active management firm around. Now, there's a peculiar problem when you're an active manager and you become bigger. Returns tend to decline because you need to focus on bigger companies. Now that you're managing $60 billion rather than $10 billion or $5 billion, you have more capital to deploy, so you can't focus on the small names that you used to. ARK doesn't seem to take that philosophy to heart. And instead, what they've done now that they have more capital is they've just bought bigger and bigger stakes in the small names they previously invested in. So the Wall Street Journal reported this first, but ARK has about 40% of their assets in companies where they own 10% or more of the shares outstanding. So they're a large shareholder, and they're a large shareholder in a lot of companies, and you know, they'll own up to 20% of a stock in some cases. And this can be problematic because ETFs, active managed ETFs, don't have permanent capital. They have inflows and outflows through a kind of confusing creation and redemption process. But you can gain a lot of assets in a day, a week, or a month, and you can lose a lot of assets in a day, week, or month if you're an actively managed ETF, especially like ARK, where your base is mainly retail investors. And now this is problematic, having a lot of illiquid securities, big stakes that are hard to sell quickly, and crazy inflows and outflows, because if you were to be hit by a lot of outflows due to poor returns or a position going really badly, then you might be forced to sell those illiquid holdings quickly. And the thing is, selling illiquid holdings quickly generally leads to getting worse prices. So if you got outflows, you'd need to sell your illiquid holdings potentially, which would lead to their prices going down, which would lead to worse performance, which could lead to more outflows, which could lead to more selling and worse performance and more outflows. And you see, it's this kind of death spiral. And what makes the ARK in a particularly precarious situation is it's well known they have this problem. They're very transparent about their trades, sending them out every day. So a hedge fund that wanted to be a little predatory, and I guarantee you this would happen, would, if they see ARK starts getting some outflows, they might apply pressure and start shorting their illiquid names with the assumption ARK is about to be a forced seller. And that makes the death spiral even worse, because you'll have everything going against you, with hedge funds really pressing your illiquid names down, driving performance down, leading to more redemptions, which would lead to you being a forced seller potentially.
So now, Edwin, we've run out of time on the broadcast part of it, but I want to kind of encapsulate what you've just said, and then let's bust into the details. But would it be fair to say that if this played out, which is entirely possible, that it could kind of be like a GameStop situation in reverse?
You know, maybe it would be better to say it's Melvin Capital in reverse,
okay,
where as GameStop was blowing up, people were front-running Melvin's trades, saying, hey, Melvin's about to blow up, let's front-run them and get some easy money as they're forced to cover their shorts and sell their longs. That would be more analogous. GameStop is kind of okay, but not a perfect example.
But the difference with Melvin Capital is they didn't control 20% of the stock, right? So if they start getting outflows, and you've got one investor like those ET, you know, like ARK, that controls 20% of the shares, and they're a forced seller, that now is a stock that it's almost impossible for that stock to go up, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can kind of see this in the market now. I think one company they own 20% of is called Compugen, an $800 million drug company. That stock, just I'm looking at it now, over the last 5 days is down 34%. Largely, I think, on ARK fear, saying, hey, ARK is starting to get redemptions. Could they be a seller of this in the near future? You'd get a lot of things going against you, yeah.
Okay, so now let's get into the where do you think the valuation play or valuation comes into this play? Because from being a guy that is we do many things here at the firm, but one of our big focuses is on, you know, the fundamentals, the traditional investing approach, not paying up. And I haven't spoken to you before, but how does any fundamental research go into this thesis of yours? Because one of the things I think about is, not only do you have this concentration of stock holding at ARK and this potential for forced selling, but the vast majority of those names in ARK, to say that they're priced to perfection is sort of like saying water is wet, right? These things are to the moon. Does the valuation of the underlying securities have anything to do with your analysis, or are you simply focused on the mechanics of it, the plumbing of the situation?
So I'm mostly focused on this liquidity issue, but the fact that these names are priced to perfection and have run up a lot are relevant to the liquidity issue, because it also suggests, like, hey, you know, Tesla's up, you know, 800% over the last year or something like that. Roku's up a ton. Square's up a ton. All their holdings are up a ton. It also means, like, it's perfectly fine for a lot of these holdings to fall 50% in a month or to be extra volatile, just because they've been extremely volatile and are up a lot. And, you know, what happens is, if you had a big pullback in ARK's holdings that have run up a lot, that might contribute to a large start of outflows, which is relevant to the liquidity problem. Because what you really care about for the liquidity is, could you get a lot of outflows quickly? And if you have a lot of names that have run up a lot quickly, you can have the big names that you hold run down quickly, and that could lead to outflows as the first part of performance deterioration.
Well, yeah, the other thing, and I think in my opinion on the valuation side, I think one of the best illustrations of this, just so people have an idea, is that if you look at a company like Tesla, if Tesla took a 50% hit to their share price, they would still be the biggest in terms of market cap. And significantly so, they would still be the biggest auto manufacturer in the world, right? So it's not that we're, you know, a lot of these names, like you said, if they took 50, 60, 70% headers, it's not like, that would be ridiculous. These things would still be sporting really enviable multiples, even after 50, 60, 70% pullbacks on a lot of those names, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, these names are tough to value and tend to kind of trade in sync. So like for a bank, you know, a cheap bank might be 0.8 times book, an expensive bank might be 1.2x book, but you generally have like a close range on what's fair value. With Tesla, you know, some people think it's worth 80% less, some people think it's worth 100% more. It's these extremely tough to value assets. And that's true for a lot of companies in their portfolio. So you could definitely see them all come down at once. But to be fair to them, you know, they're the ones who are up 600% over the last 5 years.
I think that's a really important thing to put out there, because in no way is this sour grapes on my part. I know it's not on your part. I wish I had Cathie Wood's returns over the last 5 years, right? I tip my cap. Way to get your fingers on the pulse of the market and in no way is this a slight to what ARK has done. Now, they've done it a completely different way than I would have. I never would have taken the bets that they've made. And yet, like you said, they're the ones up 600%, and this is a performance business. So, again, tip of the cap. But it just seems to me, when you just look at the economic landscape, you look at the action in rates, you look at the action in all these different things, it seems to me like the landscape is shifting right under investors' feet. And I feel like too many are flying blind, that they're not paying attention to these risks. When the 10-year goes in very short order from 0.9 to 1.5, multiples have to come down, do they not?
Yeah. I agree with that, but that's, you know, less of what my focus is on. I'm really, to me, the misunderstood thing about ARK is this liquidity issue. A lot of people for a long time have been saying these names could fall 80%, rates could rise, all that. I think that's, you know, it could be very true, but it's understood by the market. The misunderstood thing that could have really bad consequences is this liquidity issue.
Okay, so now diving back into the liquidity side of it is – so we've got, I think we've got the general framework of saying that unlike, right, I think it's really important for investors, and Edwin, part of it is we have a big retail audience. It's primarily retail that listens to us. And so one of the missions of our show is to attack these really complicated issues like GameStop, like ARK, you know, all these different things, and break them down into ways that are absorbable, right? That are understandable to the layman and the guy that doesn't do this for a living. So one of the things that I'd like you to talk a little bit about, and you hit on this in your preamble, is the difference with an ETF compared to a mutual fund. And again, you hit on it, but let's just dive deeper into that, because I don't think people understand. I guarantee you a lot of people out there go, well, what if they just don't sell? They can just hold it. They don't have to sell it. That's not how these ETFs work, correct?
Absolutely, Zach. So first, let's say how a mutual fund works. If you want to invest in a mutual fund, at the end of the day, you'll buy shares of that mutual fund. The cash will go from your account to the mutual fund's account, and then the mutual fund can invest that cash how they wish, and now you own shares in a mutual fund. Likewise, if you sell a mutual fund, the mutual fund will take cash from their account, and usually mutual funds hold some cash, and they'll give it to you for whatever the closing share price at the mutual fund is. Now, for ETFs, it's very, very different. ETFs you can buy at any point in time while the market's open. And the way ETFs get inflows and outflows is through a creation and redemption process by market makers. So if a lot of people start selling an ETF and it gets below net asset value, the fair value of their holdings, a market maker will come in and buy the ETF, buy enough shares of the ETF that then they'll go to an ARK and say, hey, we'd like to convert our ETF shares to your underlying holdings and sell the holdings. That is how an ETF shrinks. So a lot of people sell the ETF trades below net asset value, market maker comes in, buys the ETF shares, essentially converts them from ETF shares to the underlying assets and sells those assets. So the asset base of the ETF is shrinking, you get outflows. Now, if a lot of people go and buy an ETF, the ETF will start to trade above net asset value. And then the market maker will go and buy the underlying securities that are in those ETFs and convert them to ETF shares with ARK and then sell those ETF shares to individuals. And that'll help drive the price down to NAV. Most investors don't need to worry about that usually because ETFs, especially liquid ETFs, tend to trade like within plus or minus 0.1% of net asset value. Illiquid ETFs can be different. There can be special situations. But that's kind of the crux of how ETF creation and redemption works.
Okay, so if we were sitting back watching this and we wanted to know, well, let's just jump into your mind for a second. What specifically, obviously we're watching the price of ARK for part of this. What specifically are you looking for that will tell you that you know, that you really think the game is afoot? What should we be looking for? Is there any, you know, a secret sign? You know, I don't want to sound too, you know, flippant or casual, but is there some in particular thing you're looking for that would lead you to believe that first domino has been pushed over?
Yeah. So, Zach, that's an absolutely great question. The first thing that I'm looking at constantly is to see how their illiquid holdings are performing relative to their other holdings. So ARK has a lot of holdings, and you'd expect if the market senses struggle at ARK, if the market senses something is wrong, their illiquid holdings will be the first to start to get to be sold off, because these sophisticated hedge funds that want to take a predatory short position, thinking, hey, ARK's about to face outflows, they might be a forced seller, will start to short their names where they have a heavy concentration, where they own a lot of the company. And seeing underperformance in those names beyond the other names in their portfolio is one sign like, hey, the first domino might be falling. And you've seen that this week with a lot of their illiquid names. The other thing you can look at, but this is going to be closely watched, is their inflows and outflows. I believe at the end of every trading day that's posted, and I think they had their biggest outflow ever 2 days ago, about $500 million, which is not a ton in the context of going from $10 billion to $60 billion, but is still a lot when you consider like they've never really had big outflows before. The other thing that I'm watching that more people should be seeing is what are they doing with their daily trades. So ARK is very transparent. They send an email out every night around 6 or 7 saying all the trades they did for their ETF. And the biggest thing is when you find yourself in a hole, when you think you could have a potential liquidity problem, is you want to stop digging deeper. You don't want to make the problem worse. You in a way could grow out of it if you just invest all your new assets into highly liquid holdings. But that's just not happening. Instead, with the new assets that ARK has been getting, they've been initiating and adding to positions in illiquid holdings. For example, just last week, they started building a stake in a company called Voozy, which is a $900 million hot tech company that's up like 800% over the last year. And the fact that they're still initiating new stakes in really small illiquid companies where they're presumably going to take a 10, 15% stake, because that's the only way they can make a company that small meaningful to the portfolio, is a sign to me that they really either don't understand they have a liquidity issue or don't care. My guess is it's probably not understanding it fully, but I'm not completely sure.
Okay, and this is the part of it. Now, this is going to be a subjective portion of this interview because, again, I don't want to graft onto ARK or Cathy Wood my assumptions. I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's constructive. But in this environment, that is the one thing you know, and you and I both are in this business. One of the things I learned early on in my career is that when you are going against anytime you're placing a trade, whether it's a buy or sell, you need to keep in mind that there is somebody on the other side of that trade. And to assume that they're dumb and don't know is a very dangerous thing that can cost you a lot of money. And it has me before. I look at this situation, and I think that your research has done a wonderful job illuminating and putting into words a problem that I saw but didn't dig in deeply enough, not anywhere close to the level that you did. And I'm trying to wrap my head around, especially in this environment, especially what happened to Melvin. I look at this portfolio and part of me sits there and goes, do they know something I don't know? Because like you said, this looks to me similar. Again, it's like you said earlier, it's not a perfect comp. But when I look at the composition of that ARK ETF, the closest thing I'm reminded of is we were long on GameStop. We got long at $12 in October or November of last year. And we thought it was worth 20 to 25, and we thought a short squeeze could maybe take it to 40. We sold at 42. So we were involved in the GameStop thing, but not really, right? We got out right as it went ballistic. And the reason we did is there was some fundamental analysis, and there was also that incredible level of short interest, and it looked to me like a powder keg. It just looked like it was a very good risk-reward bet that this thing could squeeze a lot higher. I look at ARK, and I think the same thing because of the reasons that you're laying out. If they don't see it, how is that possible?
Well, I think part of it is, and again, I want to emphasize, I think Kathy Wood is smart. She's had outstanding returns. I like how she's focusing on innovative and productive companies. But that said, I think part of it is that they haven't actually had serious outflows before. So if you just constantly are getting inflows, at least in recent years, that might add a little hubris, or just like not, you know, make the situation of huge outflows front of your mind. I noted in my article they don't have a chief risk officer. A lot of the people at ARK come from non-traditional backgrounds.
So wait. Hold on a second. They're managing $60 billion and don't have a risk officer?
At least not one on their website. Now, they do have a chief operating officer, of course, who can sometimes maybe take that position as well. But I noted like their chief operating officer before joining ARK was an account executive at a station in Lansing, Michigan.
What?
A TV station. So it's kind of odd so you say, like, there's no way ARK could be misunderstanding this. And again, I think the ARK team's smart. They've outperformed a lot of Wall Street. But when you have a lot of people not from the traditional finance world, you don't seem to have the typical risk setup of a risk management structure of a big asset management firm. That's one sign something's wrong. You can also, I'm not the first person to raise these issues. The Wall Street Journal wrote a report 3 weeks ago, and Bloomberg's written a little. And you can look at her statements there. The Wall Street Journal asked her, like, what would happen if you got some outflows? Wouldn't you need to be selling your illiquid holdings? Couldn't that drive the pricing down? And I believe her response was something along the lines of, well, we have liquid holdings too. We would sell the liquid holdings to cover outflows. And if anyone tried to short our illiquid holdings, we'd probably prop it up with some buying pressure. And on the surface of it, that might make sense, except for two reasons. One, that's making your portfolio more illiquid.
Right.
And two, you could have sustained outflows. What if it's not just a temporary period of a week or a month where you have outflows? What if it's a sustained period where you have outflows? And her response to that was not going to happen.
Wow.
And, you know, that's a little scary because, of course, it could happen. And there's other asset managers who've had a little bit of a similar approach. There's one called Woodson in the UK. Woodford in the UK. And that collapsed in 2019 because the portfolio manager there would sell his liquid holdings to support his illiquid holdings. And after 2 years of sustained outflows, eventually you're just left with this pool of liquid stuff. stuff that's tough to price, and they needed to close the fund and give everybody their money back after it was liquidated over the course of months and months. So ARK is a little different, where it's not like they're investing in unlisted stuff or stuff that doesn't have a price every day, but it's just that a 20% stake isn't something you can sell at the current market price. You might need to sell it at a 30 or 40% discount if you need to blow out of it right away, and if people are front-running you with shorts. You know, and then even more recently, I think she called into Bloomberg Radio 2 days ago and said, like, we like the critics, bring it on. We're always excited to see people skeptical of our model, you know, and I like the enthusiasm, but it's like, this is actually a real issue. And right. I feel like, you know, you're just, you know, you're not seeing it as a real issue. You're just seeing it as, you know, frivolous skepticism. But it's real.
Yeah. Is this... It really reminds me, I will never forget, and again, I'm looking at this from the investment side, and I've been repeatedly saying that, you know, both of us have said, and I don't think we need to do it anymore, but just a cap, no one's taking personal shots here. I wish I had her P&L over the last 5 years, okay? So just right out of the gate. But this seems to really fall in line with a moment to me that was shocking. She did. It was either in 2017 or 2018. She went to the Robinhood conference, and not Robinhood the trading platform, Robinhood the investment conference, I believe, that's held in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And they had a bull bear debate there about Tesla. And they asked her point blank at one point in that discussion, is there anything? And I believe the person even repeated that. I mean, anything that would make you doubt your thesis on Tesla? And she said, absolutely not. And I sat back in my chair as a guy that manages money for a living and went, whoa, there isn't a single position I hold that I can't have doubts about, right? And I think we're seeing a pattern here, because it sounds like that sentiment was echoed in that conversation that you were just referencing with Bloomberg and even the conversation she had with the Wall Street Journal. The more and more we talk about this, this is starting to sound increasingly like, you know, was it Icarus, you know, flying too close to the sun with the it was Icarus, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. This sounds increasingly to me like Icarus flying too close to the sun and somebody believing that they can sustain 50 to, you know, 80 or 90% annual returns, which has never been done by anybody, not even close. Do you agree with that? Or do you think, again, not taking personal shots, just sitting back and trying to deduce the thought behind this stuff? Because the other thing I will tell you is that despite their projections on a lot of these stocks being just completely dialed in, and I don't want to get away from the ETF issue because that's what you focused on, but on top of the issues that you and I have talked about, I've found their research to be shockingly vapid, meaning that, you know, for instance, I remember when they came out with the $4,000 price target on Tesla, and here was all the criteria of why it was going to reach $4,000. Well, she was right. It got to $4,000, but virtually none of the criteria or the catalyst that she listed had taken place. And it seems to me like that has imbued them with a sense of confidence that in my opinion, looks like they're out over their skis. Would you concur with that?
I might phrase it a little differently, where for me, it's they've invested in some companies that have left me really scratching my head. For example, they were an investor. There wasn't their big position. It wasn't a huge position, but they were an investor in Wirecard, and they spoke highly of Wirecard.
Wow.
Even after a lot of the shorts had highlighted issues, and, you know, I think they dismissed the short thesis as very frivolous and were just looking at the technology. But, you know, and they held on to it until it collapsed. And, that was odd to me. That was one thing that still sticks out in my mind, because I know very few, like, I think most, you know, sophisticated investors were like, yeah, something's all really off about Wirecard. That was one that seemed odd to me. I also look at some of the names they hold now, like Voozy and Workhorse. Those names, to me, I've always written off in the back of my head as, yeah, those are like promotional retail names that are going to enjoy like an inflated valuation as long as they put out press releases and sell stock. But we all know it's going to end down 90%. And like, you know, then they took stakes in them, and that left me head scratching too. But, you know, So that is one thing I think of. Now, to go to your earlier thing of this huge faith in Tesla and really, you know, being married to it in a way, almost. Zach, do you know where ARK gets its name?
No.
So I was reading about this, and it's pretty fascinating. It's named after Ark of the Covenant, which is a gold chest that contained the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. according to the Bible, and... You know, I'm not a particular, and I was reading about this all last night because, you know, Kathy Wood, it turns out, is very spiritual. And she did an interview with this Christian website, Jesus Calling, where she explained why she started ARK, named it after Ark of the Covenant. She was really inspired by her, like, religious views, I guess, to start ARK. And, you know, here's a quote from the interview that kind of stood out to me. She said, like, in her early days when ARK was struggling a little, like, in the first few months, she said, you know, I would kneel down and say, okay, God, you're in control. Even if this company fails, I know I've done the right thing. This is a walk of faith for me. Your will be done. And I'm not trying to, you know, make fun or like criticize anybody's religious views at all. It's just odd to me to have that in an investing context where usually you hope people managing money, it's like, You want to be dispassionate about your views. You want to be very rigorous in your analysis. And that's a little, to me, contradictory of saying, like, oh, I've got faith that, you know, this is just going to do great because it's the right thing or the right. It struck me as very odd and a potential red flag. And again, I'm not trying to make a religious judgment here or criticize anyone's personal beliefs. But it's when you apply that to an investing or asset management context, it might become a little bit of like a personal journey or a personal quest rather than solely about the rigor of your analysis and, you know, the financial proposition of these companies.
Yeah, well, I don't think that you stepped on any toes, and I think I can speak to that because I am a believer, and my faith is a very central part of my life, and I don't make any bones about hiding that. And I pray for God's wisdom and insight on a day-to-day basis. At the same time, there is a balance there. I do God and I've listened. God doesn't give stock tips. And, you know, I agree with you that this is kind of a troubling, and again, same thing. Obviously, I'm a believer as well, so I'm not taking shots at her, and I didn't think take anything you said personally. I didn't think it was a slight, but I agree with you. I think that, in my opinion, you know, reading the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, you know, I think that we can get very confused as believers sometimes about, you know, deploying the wisdom that God's given us, in my opinion, or seeking out wisdom and seeking out knowledge, as opposed to just believing that God's going to come along the way that we are. And I don't want to go down some, you know, some religious talk or 700 Club preach session here, but that is concerning to me. No knock on anybody whose faith plays a central role in what they do every day. But at the same time, you and I both know that does, there is no guaranteed source of investment returns. And that is a very troubling thing. Now, what do you think the reason for them being so confident that the flows will continue? Again, it seems to me like they're resting their hat on having an experience running an ETF or a fund that nobody's ever had before. Right. We all know, you know, history is riddled with these examples of, you know, I think of the Janus 20. Right. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I'm sure you probably are in your research. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is not a new story. You see these people that get incredibly hot. And this is why the Buffetts and the Druckenmillers of the world have averaged 25-30% returns and not 80-90% annually. Right. Because part of that you know, investors don't want to admit that, but part of that is being in at the right place at the right time, you know, via skill, via research, not taking anything away from them. But every investor gets in markets that match them, right? I'm a big believer in there are horses for courses, right? Where you get into a market that works with the way you see it. Anytime any investor or any fund manager has extrapolated that out and just thought that that's what they can do now, that's never turned out well. As far as I know, have you? I mean, do you know of a situation in which that approach has worked?
I think you're right that history is littered with people when they get bigger, their returns fall a lot, or they tend to blow up. What was the question exactly again, Zach? I kind of missed.
Well, it is so. It looks to me like they're the way that they're running ARK and the way that she's responded in those interviews, that their business thesis is basically counting on a result that has never occurred before, like saying that we don't think we're going to get outflows. That just seems ridiculous to me. Right. Like of course you're going to get outflows. Like that's the way these things go. The world is cyclical. Right. You're not headed straight to a trillion in assets. Right.
Yeah. Or more importantly, they don't think they're going to get sustained long term outflows. And, you know, if you're adding $1 billion a week, you know, that can do a lot for your self-confidence and belief in perpetual inflows. I also think, you know, Kathy Wood's 65. She has a lot of experience in the industry. Maybe the fact that her team doesn't as much could lead a little bit to those beliefs. I find the statements very strange. It's odd, and it's also problematic because let's say this all goes away, or like, you know, they don't have a liquidity run in the next 2 or 3 months. They continue to put up great returns and they go to $100 billion in assets. It doesn't seem like they're changing their style. It seems
right.
Like if you go to $100 billion, you could have half your assets and you could be taking 30% in stakes in companies because now you're managing so much money and it could get even more illiquid. And maybe the fact that the skeptics were so wrong this time, now, you know, in December 2021, when there's actually a real collapse, you're actually really screwed with this liquidity problem and you actually do get squeezed and blown up. So I do think, like, you know, it might be a little bit, you know, $1 billion every day, every week coming into your ETFs, plus a lot of really great media coverage. Plus, it feels like at least a lot of people say they're in ARK because they like the mission. They like how it's doing good for the world and are investing in
nonsense.
Companies that are doing good for the world.
Nonsense.
It's like, those people who are retail based, I'm betting are going to be fleeing fairly quick if things get bad, even though it feels like you're really there on the mission.
Well, I know, but everybody wants to be on a mission that includes 600% returns over 5 years, right? I wonder if they'd be as fired up about the mission if she was up 30% over the last 5 years. I highly doubt it, right? That's the part of this to me that is incredible. The other thing that is amazing to me is what you just said, because I will tell you, we've got about somewhere around $150 million in our actively managed portfolios, our stock portfolios. I've had to change the way I do things going from $50 million to $150 million. And $150 million is a drop in the bucket to them. I have no idea how they think they can swing a $60 billion portfolio the same way they were swinging one with $1 billion. I can just tell you, you know, firsthand, and you can too, obviously. You know this better, you know, as good as anybody else. But the bigger you get, you have to do things differently. There are names you cannot go after. You've got to think about exits out of those names because that can be really difficult. Liquidity becomes a real issue. And the fact that they're not looking at that, I don't know, Edwin. I mean, I look at that scenario, the fact that they're not concerned about it, her own words, looking at the names in there, this looks like an eventuality to me, right? And you know, nobody ever wants to speak in those terms in the investment world, because anything can happen. But a fund like that getting hit with some significant outflows and experiencing some significant turbulence, that is only a matter of time. Everybody will get hit eventually, right?
Absolutely. Here's another thing to consider, Zach. ARK, I believe right now, is a 12-person analyst team in Cathie Wood, right? $60 billion in assets. So just look at some of their recent moves. They started investing last week in a company called Voozy, billion dollar market cap Voozy. And let's say they take a 10% stake, a big stake in the company. That's a $100 million position. If you're managing $60 billion, you can't be taking a $100 million position. Then you're going to have 600 positions.
Right.
I could understand how, like, a Citadel with thousands of analysts and different people running different portfolios, like, that could make some sense. I don't understand, like, how if you're, because of your great success, are now managing $60 billion, why you'd even be looking at $1 billion companies. But again, it's another sign there. You know, you're not adapting to the fact you're bigger, and you're setting yourself up for potential liquidity issues. The other thing, you know,
Edwin, hold on a second. And I want you to remember that, but I got to stop because I don't want to forget this. Am I looking at this Voozy company right? I'm seeing that you're looking at a company that looks like it's doing right around $10 million in revenue, trading at $1 billion market cap. Am I looking at this correctly?
Yes. So they're actually from my hometown of Rochester, New York. I'm extremely skeptical of the company. So they've been, like, publicly traded for 10 years. And, you know, the founder's very big there. And, you know, it's basically been sideways for those 10 years until recently. They make these, like, glasses you can kind of put on your face that are similar, like, to Google, in theory, similar to Google glasses, and that, like, they'll, like, identify things and, like, make things pop up on your glass screen. So if you're, like, a mechanic, you could wear them. You could look at, like, a car, and, like, the glasses would say, like, oh, that auto part needs fixing, or that identify the auto part for you, like, do stuff like that. In reality, it looks like there hasn't been, like, much legitimate progress on it. Intel owned 30% of the company at one point and sold that stake. A short seller named Richard Pearson wrote two interesting short reports on it. I think they're still on his website, moxreports.com, showing that they were tied to, like, penny stock pump and dump firms and, like, promotional IR firms. And this is a company, in the back of my head, I believe they have 80 employees in total and now $1 billion market cap. And they've just been, like, heavily promotional, but have never really delivered on the substance. So Zach, when you said $5 million in revenue, it's important to say $5 million in revenue and founded in 1997.
Right.
If it was founded in 2016 and now it's just taking off, like, some companies are like that. But when you say founded in 1997, has repeatedly made these same big claims about its technology, but has never really gone anywhere, and your big institutional backer, Intel's gone. I believe Voozy is, like, majority retail owned. It's just one of these names that really left me scratching my head.
Another thing that I wanted to hit on, and again, this is something that you and I have personal experience with, so I think we can speak to it. After you and I went back and forth on Twitter and we scheduled your appearance on the show here, we were sitting around the office and we went and looked at several of the ARK ETFs. And my first comment to our guys was, I had no idea that they had as many positions as they did. And I looked at the number of positions in the different ETFs and looked at the number of analysts they had. And my mind was blown. And the guys were like, what's the issue? And I go, there is no way that an analyst team that big can track that many stocks. There's just no way. Not with any great detail. Isn't that kind of what you were saying?
Yeah, and also that, you know, they do, you know, I think 9% of their innovation ETFs in Tesla, like 5% in Roku and Teladoc and Square. That seems to be, like, reasonably sized for your biggest positions. But the fact that, like, you'd at all be taking $100 million stakes, it's like that means you'd need 600 stocks to – it makes no sense to be taking stakes those small. because you know you're just not going to have the bandwidth to cover them all robustly. So that is the salient point there.
Well, yeah, it seems futile because you'd need a 10 to 15x for that thing to even move the needle in the portfolio, right? I mean, in a $50-60 billion portfolio, $100 million position, I mean, you know, $1 billion profit on $100 million position is what a what would that be, like a 1.3% pop to the portfolio or something? I mean, this whole thing is just quizzical to me. I look at the construction of the ETF, the analyst situation, all the different things we've discussed, and it just leaves me scratching my head. And I'm not really sure if that means that our assertion in this market, man, I really can't, I don't feel like I can call, I can rule anything out. But it's one of those things where I'm looking at it and I think it's really a binary outcome, right? Either I'm an idiot and don't understand the brilliance of ARK, or the thing's going to go down in flames. Do you think it's fair to have that kind of extraordinary, you know, that completely multipolar look at it, that binary look at it?
That might be a little extreme for me. I think the liquidity thing, it's like, if you have this liquidity potential death spiral where you end up selling your illiquid positions at depressed prices, that's something that'll happen kind of slowly and then all at once. It'll be like either that happens or it doesn't end up ultimately happening. I will say, you know, ARK does have this like big natural momentum effect where, because they get inflows, those inflows oftentimes will go into their existing names where they're big shareholders, and they'll bid up their existing names, right?
Right.
So if ARK gets 50% more in assets, odds are a lot of that new capital is going into their existing names, and those will bid up your names, and that'll like lead to those names, at least in the short term, because the market's a voting machine in the short term, like outperforming. Likewise, if you face outflows, you'd need to bid down your names as you sell them, and that'll lead to underperformance. Also, because ARK publicizes their trade data every day, retail often follows what they do. So the moment you start selling something, my guess is retail will bail, and you get this double-edged sword where on the way up, you're inflating it with your buying pressure, and your retail followers are inflating it with their buying pressure, but on the way down, you're going to have that in reverse. So that does lead a little bit to these like two paths where if you keep growing, you might get like this inflated thing going on. But if you stop and it stops working, then it really goes against you that other way. And more so because of this potential liquidity for selling stuff.
Getting back to the discussion on flows, because I want to put some scale around this. When we're talking about the inflows, we say, you know, we throw out a number like, you know, 50 billion or whatever the case may be. Can you put into perspective to us how big those flows have been into ARK? Like, you know, I know you know it better, and I'd like to hear you talk about, just so people understand the magnitude of the flows we're talking about going into that, into those funds.
So they had $10 billion 12 months ago. And they have $60 billion across, I believe it's five different funds and then two really small ETFs, but five different funds. And so $50 billion over a year is about $1 billion a week. I don't know, like, if it's been even. I think it's accelerated more in like the last 3 months as she's gotten a lot of media attention. She has like 600,000 Twitter followers. The biggest one is their innovation ETF, which has like $20 billion. I'm not an expert on how the flows have gone on the way up. One thing that's worth noting is that even though they have five different main ETF products, a lot of those ETFs own the same holdings across one another. I think like three of the different ones own Tesla, for example.
Okay. But in relation to the inflow, what I was looking for is to understand how big that is, because there were days, and again, I defer to you because you've done the work on this. You've done a lot more research on it than I have. But I saw I can't remember where I was looking at this, but I saw their flows in relation to Vanguard. And they on certain days were getting bigger inflows than Vanguard. Is that accurate?
That might be accurate. I'm not sure, though. I don't know.
I mean, it's but to put it lightly, it is staggering, right?
It is staggering. $60 billion are like, I'm sure Vanguard manages over $1 trillion. It's for the active management space, though. $60 billion is huge. It's absolutely huge. There's something I do want to talk about on this forced selling liquidity issue, though, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, you bet.
So one of my big mentors is Mark Cohodes, and he ran a fund called Copper River that was short only in like 2007, 2008. And they had a similar kind of really unfortunate blow up where they had prudent risk management, but they had all their cash custodied with Lehman Brothers. And during the financial crisis, when Lehman Brothers failed, their prime brokerage was actually Goldman. And Goldman made this like discretionary call with this Copper River fund to say, hey, your cash with Lehman, we're going to say it doesn't exist because they're having like all these issues. As a result, we're placing these huge margin calls on you now, and you basically need to cover all your short positions in the next 3 days. And the thing that is similar between Copper River and ARK is Copper River, for some of the names they were short like 10 or 15 or 5% of the float. They were big short sellers in some of these names. And there's these great graphic from a New York Times article that talked about this, is those 3 days as they were forced to cover their shorts, these names didn't go up like 5%. They went up like 30 or 40% as they were forced covers, because what happens presumably is all these prime brokers who are forcing the cover call their friends at a Citadel or Millennium being like, hey, this guy's going to be a forced buyer of the stock at any price for the next 3 days, so bid it up as much as you want. And then you get all these hedge fund guys who are just going to bid it up like crazy, knowing that this fund is being liquidated and is going to be a forced buyer. So if you want to see how this process can work like in a different context, look at the Copper River blow up and what happened there. They were right on these names. These names ended up going down a lot, so they would have been good shorts. But when you have a forced buyer or forced seller in these markets, the stocks really, really, really go against you. So just so like everybody can understand this really well, ARK owns 20% of Compugen. If it becomes clear that they're going to need to sell this stake or a similar stake because of a liquidity issue, what I think is going to happen is not only will their selling pressure drive the stock down, but all these funds who are closely watching this situation are going to be like, hey, they're going to be selling this stock at any price. Let me short a lot now, drive down the price even more now, and then buy it from them to cover the short 3 or 4 days from now. And you'll get this really wacky thing, I think, where their illiquid names will be down 30, 40% all over the course of like 3 or 4 days if they really get this kind of run on the bank situation. And then you can imagine retail, if they're looking at their ETF and the market's somewhat normal and the ARK is just down 20, 30%, they're going to be selling their ETF, which is going to lead to outflows, which will just lead to more forced selling. So you get this really wacky thing. And, you know, it seems so odd to say like it could happen, but it did happen to Copper River, and it could happen again.
Yeah. The other thing that'll be interesting to see where this goes is that this market has trained retail to buy the dip. I mean, you don't even really need, you know, you look at the last 13 years and it really has been a case of, you know, something we've laughed a lot about is why should I buy that stock? Because it's down 30%, right? Like it just buy the dip blindly, just go in there and buy it. So this to me, I feel like this could be a pretty long drawn out saga of dips and rips. Do you think that that's a possibility as well?
Yeah, I think it's totally possible. that you're going to have these dips and rips. And like one of the good questions some people have brought up is, wait a second, just last year we had the coronavirus pandemic come to the US and equity markets sold off 30 or 40%. Why didn't this cause ARK to collapse if you're so bearish on the company and blah 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 blah? And that's a great question. And my answer to that, why it didn't collapse in like past dips, was one, they were managing a lot less in assets. When you're managing $10 billion, that's different than $60 billion. Two, because you're managing less in assets, you're taking less big stakes. You're going to have less of these super illiquid stakes. And three, this issue is just not like well talked about or well known, because like this has never really happened before, at least in an active ETF management structure. But now, because of the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg and to a lesser extent myself, it is well known, and you're going to have a lot of people watching the ball from here on out on ARK.
Here's a question that you may not be able to speak to, but while we're having this discussion, one of the things crossed my mind. If you want to have... Is there a way for them to structure these ETFs differently? Because, you know, I know enough to be dangerous when it comes to the construction of ETFs, but I've never built one or ran one, so I'm a bit of a novice there. But is there a way that they could have, you know, distributed those stocks differently over the ETF or over their family of ETFs and made a smaller ETF for some of those, you know, like maybe like a microcap innovation fund or something like that to control this liquidity issue better? The other thing that's got me scratching my head is the way they've constructed the funds themselves, right? I mean, why wouldn't you just split those small illiquid names out into another fund? You know, and really monitor the liquidity side of it. Do you have any thoughts to that?
So I'm talking with an ETF expert later today. I think there are things like ETFs can do that are really weird and rare to like kind of manage their position. So earlier today on the ETF creation and redemption, I said, like, in order to create new shares of an ETF, a market maker needs to basically mirror the holdings of that ETF and then exchange them with ARK for new ETF shares. That's not exactly true. I think ARK can make exceptions where they say, hey, if you want to create new ETF shares, actually, you don't need to mirror it exactly. We'll let you do this different portfolio of stocks, give them to us, and we'll issue you ETF shares. And that can change the ETF concentration. Another thing that they've been doing, which I find a little odd, is they have like themed ETFs. They have a genomics ETF, which is focused on life sciences and companies that I think they say make the world a better place. And then you look at like the recent add to the genomics portfolio, and I think they bought like $200 million worth of Google. And you're like, huh, what is Google doing in a genomics portfolio? Or like Pure Storage, which is like, you know, a cloud storage business. What is that doing in a genomics portfolio? So sometimes I wonder, like, it's a little odd to have five different funds, especially like if you're going to make the mandated funds, but you're not following the mandate as clearly as you'd expect. It's kind of odd. I'm not sure if you could split off the liquid holdings like into a sidecar or a different ETF, because then that ETF would just be having really big stakes and only small caps, and I think even more susceptible to being blown up.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
But the easiest thing you could do that is so easy is just say, hey, you might even not believe it's a big problem, but you know there's a potential for a problem here. Just say, hey, every new dollar of inflows, we are going to put in a company that has a bigger market cap than $10 billion. And that way, your portfolio that is a big stakes in a small caps, that'll get smaller as a percent of the ETF. And as you slowly whittle down those stakes just with time, when the valuations get where you want, you'll transition to a bigger firm. But it's like, it just... You could not imagine a hedge fund with $60 billion in assets taking stakes in like $500 million companies. That just would never happen if you had $60 billion in assets, or no, at least not happen multiple times. And the thing is, the hedge funds have permanent capital. So an ETF, which has very temporary capital, temporary on a daily basis, shouldn't be taking all these stakes. That's the one thing I kind of like think about to really say this situation's odd. A hedge fund with $60 billion in assets, which would be extremely, extremely, extremely big by hedge fund standards, like, it is focusing on highly liquid, big companies. ARK, with $60 billion in assets, does that a little, but is also having half their portfolio in $1 billion, $2 billion companies, sub $1 billion companies, where they just take a huge stake, and it's like it doesn't work at this size.
All right, pal. Well, in closing, and I've really enjoyed this conversation, and we're not in a rush, but in closing, is there anything that you wanted to go over or illuminate regarding this situation or anything else you're looking at? Just kind of as, you know, your closing thoughts for us to kind of wrap this up, and anything that we've skipped that you think is important that we address?
Two closing thoughts. One is, I actually like Cathie Wood. I think she's somewhat thoughtful when she speaks. She's really refreshing compared to a lot of the people in the industry, because you get the sense she's sincere. I get the sense she actually does like want to try to invest in companies that are making the world better. Like, now, you know, you are charging 85 basis points on ETFs with $60 billion in assets. I'm sure you're making tons of money, and that's a partial motivation there. But when I hear her speak, I don't get the sense, like, I don't think she's stupid at all, and I know people online say that, and that frustrates me, because she's obviously not.
No.
She's thoughtful. She's been very early on a lot of stuff and right, so not just Tesla, but I believe in 2015 she was talking about Bitcoin when it was $1,000. Now it's, you know, $50,000. So even if like you believe she might be focusing on frivolous things, she's very early. She's very savvy with a lot of this stuff. You know, I genuinely think what she's doing with transparency is a good for the market. You know, her returns have been outstanding. I really, for me, it's more of a focus on this liquidity issue and a misunderstanding of this liquidity issue, a potential arrogance around this liquidity issue. The second thing is, you mentioned it earlier, but I write this newsletter called The Bear Cave. And if people want to see what I wrote, they can just Google The Bear Cave newsletter and find all my writings on Cathie Wood there. Jason Zweig at The Wall Street Journal has also been doing really good writing on this.
And you also have a subscription service where you dive in deeper, don't you? Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Precisely. So this newsletter I started right after graduating college. It's grown to about 12,000 free subscribers. We'll provide like weekly updates on what's going on in the short world, and sometimes special investigations like this Cathie Wood thing. And then there's a paid service where for $44 a month or $440 a year, basically the paid subscribers will get a write-up from me on the first and third Thursday every month on, I don't want to say a potential short idea, but I'll highlight a company that's like misleading investors or consumers. Usually it's going to be like a 1,000-word write-up. I'm particularly strong with FOIA requests. I send a lot of FOIA requests. So I might like highlight a company that has a lot of complaints with the regulator or just some issue the market's missing. And it's pretty popular among short biased analysts. And the newsletter is called The Bear Cave. There's a bunch of past reports on there that people could check out.
And they can also follow you on Twitter, which I do. And I, like I said, I think you're a bright up and coming name in the industry. And I think people should subscribe to that letter and also follow you. They can follow you at Stock Jabber, Jabber with two B's, J-A-B-B-R. Great follow. That's how I got you. You know, that's how I found you. But anyway, pal, I really appreciate you coming on and impressed by your work. We're going to keep an eye on this, and perhaps when this starts to unfold, we can get you back on to discuss it. And more than that, just wish you all the best of luck in the world. I think you're a really bright guy. I think you got a really promising future, and we're going to keep an eye on you and your research and watch with a vested interest.
Zach, thanks so much. I really enjoyed this. I hope your viewers do too.
All right. Well, hey, you guys, we got to roll. I appreciate you joining us. And as always, we will be back next week. We got another great interview lined up. I'm not going to tell you who it is. You got to tune in to hear it. But anyway, have a wonderful weekend. We will be back next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.